Good morning. It's good to see everyone this morning. We are in the last three chapters of the book of Genesis. That's a fair amount of material, especially if you think about all that's covered there. Now, it came to pass after these things that Joseph was told, "Indeed, your father is sick," and took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And Jacob was told, "Look, your son Joseph is coming to you." And Israel strengthened himself and sat up on the bed. Then Jacob said to Joseph, "God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me and said to me, 'Behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you. I will make of you a multitude of people and give this land to your descendants after you as an everlasting possession.' And now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in the land of Egypt, before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. Your offspring, whom you begat after them, shall be yours. They'll be called by the name of their brothers in their inheritance. But as for me, when I came from Padan, Rachel died beside me in the land of Canaan on the way, when there was but a little distance to go to Ephrath, and I buried her there on the way to Ephrath, that is, Bethlehem. Then Israel saw Joseph's sons and said, 'Who are these?' And Joseph said to his father, 'They are my sons, whom God has given me in this place.' And he said, 'Please bring them to me, and I will bless them.' Now the eyes of Israel were dim with age, so that he could not see. Then Joseph brought them near him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, 'I had not thought to see your face, but in fact, God has also shown me your offspring.' So Joseph brought them from beside his knees, and he bowed down with his face to the ground. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh with his left toward Israel's right hand, and brought them near him." Now, bear in mind that ordinarily the one on the right would get the opening, the best blessing. Out of six people, five of them would be right-handed. So in Scripture, most of the time, you talk about right hand, you talk about the strong hand. And that's generally correct, you know. So it makes sense when you think about it. So Joseph is trying to make it easy on his dad. Manasseh is the firstborn. And bear that in mind, because from this point forward, if you think about it, we always call them the other way around, Ephraim and Manasseh. We always do. If you watch the text, That's the way Jacob does it from the outset, and he's going to keep doing that despite everything. So just laying that out, just a little there. Then Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, who is the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hand knowingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. Now, all I can do is assume. And that I'm assuming that that Jacob anticipated what Joseph would do. And so instead of putting his hands out like this, like he normally would, he does this with them. And that's going to lead to some confusion. Joseph, when he tries to correct him, I want all of us to understand, he's not saying, "Dad, you're wrong." What he's saying is, I switched them already for you. You know, he's thinking for his dad. You know, but we're going to hear different from his dad. So we'll see how that goes. And he blessed Joseph and said, "God, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who fed me all my life along to this day, the angel who redeemed me from all evil." Now, you know, it's God, angel. Angel of the Lord is God. And you need to see that. You see it over and over in the Old Testament that way. "Bless the lads. Let my name be upon
are be named upon them, in the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac. And let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. Now, when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him. So he took hold of his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, "Not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head." But his father refused and said, "I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. But truly, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations." Now, later on, when Israel and Judah split, oftentimes Israel, the northern kingdom, is called Ephraim. See, that's how powerful that one tribe becomes in the future, somewhere out down the road. So, we're dealing with prophecy. God's able to inspire, and apparently he is inspiring Jacob at this moment. So he blessed them that day, saying, "By you Israel will bless, saying, may God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh." And thus he set Ephraim before Manasseh. Then Israel said to Joseph, "Behold, I am dying, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers. Moreover, I have given to you one portion above your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and with my bow." And the way he's doing that is he's making each of these boys be his boys, effectively. Clyde Woods, in his commentary on the Pentateuch, says that when these boys are put at his knee, that is, in that world, that's the sign of adoption. He is adopting them as his children. So they end up being counted as part of his children. And so when you count the 12 tribes, you don't hear Joseph. You hear Ephraim and Manasseh. And you might say, wait a minute, that gives 13, except what about Levi? See, Levi didn't get any land. And we'll talk about that more as we go on through. But that's how you end up with 12 tribes dividing the land. And yet you've got a 13th tribe if you do it the way that Jacob's doing it right now. So that's the explanation for that. And Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days. Gather together and hear, you sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel, your father. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power. Unstable as water, you shall not excel. Because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch." All right, now see, some of these stories, when they happened, you don't hear anything from Jacob. Don't hear a word. No, nothing within the text. Even for sure lets us know that he knew, but he does know. And it's coming up now in the blessing. The word unstable here is later used in the Old Testament to describe a reckless mob, like in Judges 9:4. According to Sarna, who's quoted by Whitworth, it describes an irresponsible, impetuous manner. So he went up to his father's concubine, and that was irresponsible and impetuous. He didn't control his emotions. He didn't think about what he was doing before he did it. Let me warn all of us, beware of impetuous responses. They can be very dangerous. They're not thought out by any of us, that get involved in them. And it's dangerous. It cost Reuben in the blessing and, of course, in what he received as firstborn or not being counted as firstborn. "Simeon and Levi are brothers, instruments of cruelty, are in their dwelling place. Let not my soul enter their council. Let not my honor be united to their assembly. For in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." Okay,
Simeon gets a piece of land and it's smack dab in the middle of Judah's land. So really, it's never really counted to speak of as Simeon's. It's listed one time, you know, basically that way, but then you don't hear about it that way anymore. Levi doesn't get any land at all, except the cities that he's given. That's it. He doesn't get a specific area, instead just these cities. Of course, cities of refuge are included in that. This goes back to another incident that we've already looked at. You know, when Dinah was abused, mistreated, and they lashed out and killed not just one man, they killed basically a whole community. And you know, remember Jacob said, "You've made me be a stink in the nostrils of my neighbors." You know, and he didn't appreciate it at all. And you see the result here. Judah, you are he whom your brothers shall praise. Your hands shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you've gone up. He bows down, he lies down as a lion. And as a lion, who shall rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and he shall be the obedience of the people. Okay, Shiloh is a reference to Jesus. Shiloh is a variation word peace. He is the Prince of Peace. You see that in Isaiah chapter 9, for example. It's also brought up in the discussions when you talk about Melchizedek, who is king of Salem, also a form of the word peace. Binding his donkey to the vine, his donkey's colt to the choice vine, he washed his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine, his teeth whiter than milk. Zebulun shall dwell by the haven of the sea. He shall become a haven for ships, and his border shall adjoin Sidon. So if you're looking at a map of Israel, and I know you all just really appreciate my awful maps, but if you, I always just do the area that goes a little bit like this, down to Egypt. Egypt's down here. You have Israel laid out along this coastal region. Tyre and Sidon are up in this area. So we have Zebulun up in here. Now, if you think much about the way this nation's laid out, what you've got is a series of mountains. You've got the coastal range, you've got the intermediate range, and then across the river you've got another range of mountains. So when an army would come down from the north, or if it came up from the south, they always went tracking through this area. Ultimately, this, and I'm not dividing it well, but this part up in here becomes, in the New Testament, this is Galilee. And so Zebulun ends up being a large part of where Jesus wanders while he's on the earth in his ministry. Anytime he's in Galilee, he's at least near Zebulun, you know, in what he's doing. So very fruitful land. It's in a beautiful spot, you know, for that to be the case, with the Mediterranean Sea on this side and both the Jordan River and, of course, the Sea of Galilee, as we call it. Old Testament, it's usually Chinnereth, and I probably don't say that right. But that's the Old Testament name for it. So that's what he's referring to. Issachar is a strong donkey lying down between two burdens. He saw that rest was good and that the land was pleasant. He bowed his shoulder to bear burden and became a band of slaves. Issachar, unfortunately, not always the best thing. I mean, before I go beyond Zebulun, let me note these notes that we put in there. It's an international trade route. Well, that's pretty obvious because the mountains keep any other way from being a good way to go with your camels and things like that. You don't want to lose your beast of burdens, so they stay along the coast. and the Shephelah, which is a sloping area that goes down from the mountains down to the lake.
That is what it is. So it is an international trading route, and therefore a lot of commerce goes on there. Zebulun was a responsive group of people when Barak, called for help. They joined in. When Gideon called for help, they joined in. They're quick to go to the fight in a good way, to help out with whoever needs them. Zebulun provided 50,000 loyal troops to David. That's a pretty fair number. Of course, he's king by then. When they do that, but they do that very readily. And of course, then, as I already noted, that Jesus ends up ministering in large measure in that region. Now we can go on. I should have done that before I went to Issachar. Issachar received a beautiful land, but what did he say? He said they ended up being slaves. Why did they do that? Because they just bowed down like a donkey. They took it. Whatever anybody gave to them, they just took it. And so they end up being slaves. Everybody around them takes advantage of their weakness. And again, I don't want to encourage anybody to be mean or hard, but if you let folks, they'll take advantage of you. And that's exactly what they do with Issachar. They take advantage of them. Now, then he goes on. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent by the way, a viper by the path, that bites the horse's heels so that its rider shall fall backward. I have waited for your salvation, O Lord. Okay, Dan, of course, remember, you've got Dan is the most northernmost of all the tribes. And any group that came in there to attack Israel, they'd have to cross over Dan first. And Dan's described like a serpent, which indicates they may have been, kind of like the guerrilla warfare that was fought in the American Revolutionary War. They'd let the enemy get by, and then they'd be biting at their heels, the whole way down. And they become, therefore, very useful in the defense of Israel. They're trouble to any invaders that come by that way. And they just about have to come that way, because that's the northern part of Israel. Then he goes on, Gad, a troop shall triumph upon him, but he shall triumph at last. Gad was troubled with invaders, but defended itself well over time. The invaders would attack, and they would ultimately win. Bread from Asher shall be rich, and he shall yield royal dainties. Fertile land. And fertile land, opens up the opportunity to raise all kind of grain. What number one grain in Israel, watch your later readings in the Old Testament when somebody attacks. You're going to see that they prefer, just like we do, wheat. Wheat's the number one, grain, probably, when you start talking about cooking. Because that's generally where we get our flour. I know you get rice flour and all that other. I'm fully acquainted with all that stuff. But the primary flour comes from wheat. Barley was the secondary, interesting, much rougher grain. And if you watch your attacks again, you'll notice where they get in real trouble. Not only does wheat become scarce, but even barley, becomes scarce in attacks that come on later. Well, all that just to say that Asher is a fertile land, and because of that, she provides for the nations, or this tribe provides good food for the king and so forth within the nation. Naphtali is a deer let loose. He uses beautiful words. Naphtali was a skillful warrior, swift in his movements. They helped Deborah and Barak defeat the armies of Jabin, who is king of Canaan. That's in Judges chapters 4 and 5. So that takes you through the bulk now until we finally get to Joseph. Joseph is a fruitful bough. A fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall. The archers had bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him. But his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong. Now, think about the description, and in our area, it's almost meaningless. But in Israel, if you had a tree, and boy, forgive me for my tree, but if you have a tree that's planted by a water, then the tree's going to grow strong. I noticed that he describes Joseph as a bough that's planted by a well. Well, then it's going to have plenty of water, right? And some of you, I don't very often water, but some folks water in the summer when it goes dry, you know, to keep their stuff alive. Well, if a well was close by, that would be helpful in this part of the world, because they can't go over and turn the spigot on. You know, they've got to get the water out of the well to be able to water the tree. So that's the description of Joseph. Attacked? Oh man, you know, we know what these attacks are. His brothers, you know, mistreated him. And yet he survived. He came through strong. Ends up being governor. This is maybe a poetic reference to that. That's at least a decent possibility. I intentionally stopped because I want us to look at something. Watch the ways that God is named by Jacob now as he goes on about Joseph. I'll back up and read 24 again in whole now, its entirety. But his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. And for there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel, by the God of your father, who will help you, and by the Almighty, who will bless you. If you're following, you've got several names then that are laid out there for God. So what names do you see there? Yeah. Mighty God. I had to double check, so I'm pretty sure that's El Shaddai. What's the next one? Shepherd. God's a shepherd. Now, not too surprising later when Jesus describes himself this way. I think John 10 is where he'll talk about that. John 10, he's the shepherd that lays down his life for the sheep. Okay, what other name? What, stone of Israel? Stone. So you got stone of Israel. And if you think about where they live, well, even think about us. If you don't build a house, what do? They put down a concrete pad, for the most part. I'm not saying you can't build it the other way, but for the most part, concrete pad, that's kind of man-made stone in a sense of the word. I'm being careful. I know there's crushed rock in it and so forth, but he's a foundation. Something you can build on, something you can count on. Stone will hold up as opposed to sand or, you know, the mobile soil. And boy, in this area, it's one of the reasons why, you know, we're very careful about foundations, right? Post-tension stress, all that stuff, which I know very little about. But anyway, that's stone vision. What else? Okay, God of your fathers. Okay, so God of your fathers, and we're talking there about, of course, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God of the fathers. Okay? Almighty. Not anybody's more powerful than he is. And so, five different names for God, by the way, in a little book called Getting Acquainted with God, Hugo McCord looked at every new name for God in the book of, well, it started off preeminently in the book of Genesis, because most of them are in Genesis. There are about 30 different names for God.
that are in the Old Testament. Starting off with in chapter 1 of Genesis, Elohim, which is a name of power. It's got the plurality of power. And that same plurality is used in reference to princes and kings sometimes. Doesn't have to be more than one. It could be just one king. He's got power, and therefore plurality of power. We don't tend to use that plurality of power, but they did. Second name in the Old Testament for God is Ruach Elohim, which is Spirit of God. That's in verse 2 and 3, Genesis chapter 1. And then the third name is Jehovah, which, by the way, is not used by any between God and any man in the book of Genesis. It doesn't really come up as a name in relation to man until the establishment of the law of Moses. And I should say, Moses at the burning bush, when he says, "Who shall I tell him sent me?" He says, "Well, I am sent me." And that's basically Yahweh. But that's the third name. I'm not going to go through all of them. For one thing, I won't remember all of them. But for the other, it's rather extensive. But here, Jacob, singles out five names for God. And he wants it understood that in every aspect of your life, God's there. He's capable. And he certainly proved to be that for Joseph. He took care of him in terrible circumstances. So, let me back up again. By the hand of your Father, who will help you, and by the Almighty, who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the beast of the womb. Boy, isn't this a great week to be reading this passage? The blessings. All of us need to think about the blessings. How are we blessed? Somebody, I stopped by a grocery store briefly yesterday. They said, "How are you doing?" I said, "I'm doing great. I'm doing fine." She said, "That's good." I said, "In fact, I think I feel better right now than I did 10 years ago." And I do. As far as feeling, I don't know what a doctor would say. They might find all kind of problems if I went to them. But we're blessed. Man, are we blessed. And I'm not sure we do enough listing of the blessings. Another thing that came up yesterday in conversation with going downstairs was we got a lot of clothing that we're laying in, getting ready for the next clothing giveaway. Most of that comes from just the people here. You think about how many clothes we have. We got enough clothes that we can haul it out in bags. And in the rest of the world, that would not be true. That would be extraordinarily rare. There are people who have, almost an entire closet dedicated to shoes. I didn't say anybody here. Did that. But there are, some families, we got a he closet and a she closet. This is hers. It could be a walk-in, but it's all hers. Nothing else but her stuff. We're just blessed. Bountifully, bountifully blessed. And we need to be thankful for it all the time. The blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors. Up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills, they shall be on the head of Joseph, and on the crown of the head of him who is separate from his brothers. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey, and at night he shall divide the spoil. Ravenous wolf. Wolves don't eat all day long. So they are often described as they're very dangerous animals. They run in packs. And at night they will attack, and they're not much afraid to attack anyone if they're in a pack. They'll go after them. So ravenous wolves, good title for them. They're hungry from not eating all day long. They divide the spoil
He says in the morning, and that, I'm sure he don't know better than I do, but that's the wolf. Why would Benjamin be described that way? This may be the most vicious and fighting tribe that there is in the land of Israel. And in fact, it's unfortunate that this tribe plays a critical role in one of the terrible chapters in Israelite history. In the book of Judges, you get toward the end of the book and you'll see them there. I think they make a defense that doesn't need to be made, but God uses it. He knew their nature and they went ahead and did what they did. But they're a powerful, powerful nation. Who is from the tribe of Benjamin? What significant character? Do what? He was. That's very good. I'm thinking Old Testament. You went new, and you're right. I'm sorry. I was Paul. Well, interestingly enough, what was his name in Hebrew? What was his name? It was Saul. Well, guess who else is from Benjamin? The other Saul. New Testament Saul, but also Old Testament Saul. First king of Israel is from. Excuse me. Is from Benjamin. And so, interesting tribe. All these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father spoke to them. And he blessed them. He blessed each one according to his own blessing. Then he charged them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field of Ephron the Hittite as a possession for a burial place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah, his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah, his wife. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is there were purchased from the sons of Heth. And when Jacob had finished commanding his sons, he drew his feet up into the bed and breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. By a euphemism, obviously, means he died. All his people are dead. So he's gathered to them. Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. It's been about 17 years that they had together. And if you put it all together, I guess it would be about 34. 17 at home before he was sold, 17 after Jacob comes to Egypt. He may have appreciated his father more than any of the boys did. And I think I can make that argument successfully because the other boys were willing to let him suffer and not tell him the truth that they sold their brother. Now, God used that. Don't misunderstand me. He used it. And I think it's meant to be that way, that God would use it that way. But still, Joseph has a special relationship with his father, and you can see it at any moment, especially now when his dad dies. Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. 40 days were required for him, for such are the days required for those who are embalmed. And the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. He's treated like royalty when he dies. And remember, we've already said he blessed Pharaoh, which means he's the greater, not Pharaoh. And the Egyptians in some ways acknowledge that. Maybe unknowingly, I'm not arguing one way or another about that, but they do honor him in some ways in that way. Now, when the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, if now I found favor in your eyes, please speak in the hearing of Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying, behold, I am dying in my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan. There you shall bury me. Now, therefore, please, let me go up and bury my father, and I will come back. Pharaoh said, go up and bury your father, as he made you swear. So Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, as well as all the house of Joseph, his brothers, his father's house, Only their little ones, their flocks and their herds, they left in the land of Goshen. And there went up with him both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great gathering. Then they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, and they mourned there with great and very solemn lamentation. He observed 7 days of mourning for his father. And when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, "This is a deep mourning of the Egyptians." Therefore, its name was called Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan. Of course, they name any name that they choose is invariably tied to what's going on. That's how they come up. They come up with these various titles that they have, and that means the mourning of Egypt, which is interesting. You and I would say, well, yes and no. I mean, a lot of Egyptians there, but the real mourners here are what later will occupy the land, but they call it mourning of Egypt because that's what they saw. So his sons did for him just as he commanded them. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan, buried him in the cave in the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite as property for a burial place. And after he buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers, and all who went up with him to bury his father. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "Perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for the evil which we did to him." I'm going to give you the reaction, the thing I see most often in people, the thing that upsets you the most and you fear the most in others is what you would do yourself. These boys, you just look at their lives and tell me if they'd had the chance to get even with somebody, would they have done it? Simeon and Levi, that's easy. You know, you got them nailed down. That's what they would do exactly. But that's the way these boys react. And they basically put their feelings on Joseph. That's pretty common, you know, for us to do that. I often warn parents, whatever it is that irritates you about your child, you may need to slow down and think about what you do. Because I can guarantee the thing that irritates me most about my children is things that they do that they probably learned from me. You know, just being honest about it. But anyway. So they sent messengers to Joseph saying, "Before your father died, he commanded, saying, 'Thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespasses of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you. Now, please forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of your father.' And Joseph wept when they spoke to him." I don't know whether Jacob really said that or not. It sounds made up to me, to be honest about it. But he might. Maybe he did. But whatever it is, it hurts Joseph because it's not his nature. He's not inclined that way. And you see that in his response to what they have to say, what he said, what they said. Then his brothers also went and fell down before his face, and they said, "Behold, we are your servants." See, they sent people ahead as messengers to soften him up, and then they come. And I often say, hat in hand, you know, kind of is the approach that they take. Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring it about, as it is this day, to save many people alive." So now he's lived up to his name, and it shows again, Asenath Panea. He's savior of people, savior of life, preserver of life, is what he is. "Now, therefore, do not be afraid. I'll provide for you and your little ones." And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. So Joseph dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's household. Joseph lived 110 years. Joseph saw Ephraim's children to the third generation. The children of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were also brought up on Joseph's knees. And Joseph said to his brethren, "I am dying, but God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to a land of which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." Then Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, "God will surely visit you, and you should carry up my bones from here." So Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. So the book of beginnings, ironically, ends with a coffin in Egypt. And for the longest time, that's all I noted about it. And then one day, in studying, it came to me that this may be the greatest beginning of all. Because I'm not superseding something God can do. We don't talk about other laws, but with men. This may be the greatest beginning. Because the coffin in Egypt says, you are coming out. There will be an exodus one day. And that coffin always stood, if they would allow it to, it stood as a reminder. It was constantly before them as a reminder. You're leaving here. Joseph didn't want to be buried here because we're not staying. We're just part-time dwellers in this place. Now, it got rough, true enough. But that coffin should have always reminded them that a new beginning is coming. All right, next week begins a whole new quarter. And as we begin that quarter in here, I'm going to be teaching, I think with Andy, if I remember right. And we're going to teach on the book of Luke. We're going to do it in two quarters. Now, those that go to B2, is that right? Is that what we finally came up with? Those that go to B2 will be with Richard. He also will take two quarters to cover Luke, because he's like me. He don't see how you're going to do it in one quarter and do it any justice. It's going to be hard to do in two quarters, but that's what we're going to do. But he's got a wonderful take on things. If you want to go to that class, feel free. It'll be good. And I don't remember all the others, being honest about it. But it will be in the bulletin. Look this week and decide what classes you're going to. On Wednesday night, the question series will end this Wednesday with a question about what should we be thankful for. And next Wednesday, I think, here's where I need to double check, but I think I'm supposed to be on church growth is what I'm going to be talking about. And that's a fun study, or was for me. So hopefully we'll share in that. Thank you very much.